Each time a lasting silence settled over the wrecked building. At daybreak, the Americans moved in and realized and discovered that 77 Japanese Marines had killed themselves with grenades on the opposite side of the building. MacArthur refused to allow planes to bomb the city for fear of killing civilians, but he relented and permitted artillery after American troops suffered hefty casualties crossing the river. Quote, from then on, putting it crudely, we really went to town, recalled General Robert Baylor of the 37th Infantry. Over the course of the battle, American forces would fire more than 42,000 rounds of artillery and mortars into the city. Sixth Army Commander General Walter Krueger described it best when he said, quote, some districts of the city were completely destroyed. Between Japanese demolitions and American artillery, Manila was being destroyed from the inside and the out. Men, women, and children retreated below ground where conditions inside cramped air raid shelters devolved as the hours turned to days. With so many bodies pressed together, the air inside stagnated and the heat soared. Austrian Hans Steiner, in a letter to his mother, recounted his experience. Quote, we lived like dogs, he wrote. All around us there were fires and explosions. It was the best imagination of hell one could get. And of course, such shelters proved easy prey for marauding Japanese troops, who often lobbed grenades inside. That was the case for this man, whose cheek was ripped away by shrapnel from a grenade. Many proved too injured to walk, including this woman, who was placed in a basket by her neighbors for transportation to an aid station. In his diary, Santo Tomas internee Peter Weigel described the parade of wounded who came to the university in search of help from the American doctors. Quote, they are so far beyond recognition that in many cases, one can't tell whether they are men or women, boys or girls, dead or alive. By February 9th, Iwabuchi realized the fight was lost. The Americans were across the river and pressing into central Manila. His fortifications along the city's southern border threatened to collapse. The Americans had far more firepower and far more troops. At that point, the fight took a very evil turn, devolving from a battle over one of Asia's great cities into one of the worst human catastrophes of World War II. An examination of the timeline of dozens of atrocities that occurred in Manila point to February 9th as the fulcrum on which the violence against civilians shifted from individual attacks against suspected guerrillas to organized mass extermination. American war crimes investigators would later tally 27 major atrocities just inside Manila. The Japanese tossed babies in the air, skewering them on bayonets. Troops decapitated hundreds of others with swords and burned thousands to death alive. The merciful ones received a bullet. In one such example, Japanese Marines stormed the Red Cross headquarters and bayoneted more than 50 civilians and two infants who had taken refuge there. One infant was just 10 days old. The Japanese likewise burned to death more than 500 men, women, and children who had taken shelter inside the German Club, which was a social club in downtown Manila. Troops forced hundreds of other civilians into the dining hall at St. Paul's College, where they rigged the chandeliers with explosives and then dynamited, killing 360 people. In one of the more gruesome crimes, Japanese converted a home on Sing-Along Street into a house of horrors. Troops cut a hole in the floor of an upstairs room and then marched blindfolded civilians inside, forcing them to kneel over that hole. A Japanese Marine then cut each person's head off with a sword before kicking the body into the hole. War crimes investigators, counting skulls, later determined that 200 men died this way, though 9 survived. Those are two of the men who survived. This is actually a sketch that was done March 25th, 1945 by one of the survivors that showed the layout inside that that home where these murders took place. And the atrocities went beyond murder. Japanese rounded up thousands of women, locking many of them inside these four buildings, the last one being the infamous Bayview Hotel. There in rooms, and Bayview was actually where Jean MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur's wife, lived when she first moved to the Philippines. So there at the Bayview, in rooms where tourists had once enjoyed Manila's legendary sunset, Japanese troops assaulted hundreds of women. Quote, I was raped between 12 and 15 times during that night. I cannot remember exactly how many times, one victim later testified. I was so tired and horror-stricken that it became a living nightmare. The Japanese did not discriminate. They killed men and women, the old and the young, the strong and the infirm. Alongside thousands of Filipinos, the Japanese slaughtered Russians, Spaniards, Germans, Americans, and Indians, as well as two Supreme Court justices, the family of a senator, and scores of priests. Quote, the list of known dead that has come to my attention sounds like a who's who of the Philippines, Attorney Marshall Lachauca wrote in his diary. Those residents who were able began the long march out of the city, a dangerous journey through an apocalyptic wasteland. The Americans were so inundated with escaping refugees that engineers had to build a pontoon bridge over the river to help ease the flow out. Now, by the morning of February 23rd, American forces had isolated the last of Iwabuchi's forces inside Intramuros and a handful of surrounding government buildings. The fight to retake the walled city began with a massive artillery barrage at 7:30 a.m., one so destructive that it literally blackened the sky, turning day into night. And that's actually looking down the river where the walled city is down there on the bay, and it gives you a sense of just how bad it was. In 1 hour, American forces fired 10,000 artillery and mortar rounds into that 160-acre Intramuros. Every second of the bombardment saw an average of 3 shells fired, creating a continuous rolling thunder that rendered telephones worthless. For those civilians trapped inside, it was terrifying. Quote, we could not even see each other because of the smoke, one later said. We thought that we were all going to die. At 8:30 a.m., the assault troops moved in. If you click it one more time, it'll zoom in. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. The ensuing silence, recalled one journalist, seemed louder than the bombardment. Once inside, troops discovered that survivors were almost exclusively women and children. War crimes investigators later determined that the Japanese had killed an estimated 4,000 men inside the walled city in the days leading up to the assault. The Japanese had locked many of them inside cells at Fort Santiago and burned them. Hundreds of others were found piled on top of one another, sealed inside the underground dungeons. Many of the children rescued were now orphans, including these three, one carrying a bucket of utensils and the other a baby doll. But the battle was not over. America still had to eliminate the last of Iwabuchi's forces, holed up inside a handful of government buildings that ring the walled city. America blasted the legislature with artillery and then sent in assault troops. The building eventually fell at noon on February 28th, and that's the remains of it there behind you. Or behind me, sorry. Troops then pounded the agriculture and finance buildings, the latter of which is pictured here in the bottom left. Iwabuchi decided to make his final stand inside the agricultural building. Quote, if we run out of bullets, we will use grenades, he told his men. If we run out of grenades, we will cut down the enemy with swords. If we break our swords, we will sink our teeth into their throats. But his vigor withered under the onslaught of America's merciless guns, which pulverized the columns and ripped gaping holes in the concrete walls around him. Iwabuchi had presided over one of the most barbaric massacres of World War II. His troops had wantonly slaughtered tens of thousands of men, women, and children in some of the most cruel and horrible ways. Survival was not an option, and he knew it. He summoned his last remaining forces, and he apologized for leading them to doom. Quote, if anyone has the courage to escape, please do so, he instructed them. If not, please take your lives here. The admiral then retreated to his quarters on the main floor of the building, where, armed with a knife, he slit open his belly. A handful of Japanese troops did, in fact, surrender, like this Marine, pulled out of the agricultural building. But most, however, chose to die. On March 3rd, 29 days after American troops had rolled into the city, the Battle of Manila finally ended. The fight to retake the Philippine capital had resulted in the deaths of 16,665 Japanese, the near total destruction of Admiral Iwabuchi's forces. In contrast, MacArthur's men suffered a little over 1,000 killed and another 5,500 wounded. Civilians bore the brunt of the horror, with an estimated 100,000 killed, many of those slaughtered by the Japanese. The dead were often so disfigured that relatives had to identify them through clothes, cigarette cases, and keychains. And click it one more time. Yeah, it'll sort of come in. Those who found remains were the lucky ones. Others would have no resolution. Over the city of Manila hung the awful stench of the dead. Worse than the smell, remembered Major Chuckhen, was the taste of death, which settled on the tongue. Quote, no amount of spitting, he recalled, could clear it away. The battle for Manila had leveled 613 city blocks, an area containing 11,000 buildings ranging from banks and schools to churches and houses. More than 200,000 people were left homeless. Post-war American survey estimated that the damages to Manila by today's figures would run more than $10 billion. And beyond those structural losses, of course, were the cultural ones, from historic churches and museum paintings, and statues to priceless literary works. And, of course, the economy was in shambles, a sentiment best described by Abraham Hartendorp, who was an intern at Santo Tomas, when he said, quote, the manager of one of the Manila oil companies, in speaking of rebuilding his plant, stated that he would have to begin again at the beginning with a land survey. Amid this sea of destruction, MacArthur returned to the Manila Hotel to find his home in ruins. Click it twice and it'll zoom in. Yeah. Gone was his vast personal library, his father's Civil War mementos, his son Arthur's baby book, a loss that crushed Gene MacArthur. Quote, you wanted to know about my apartment at the hotel, Gene wrote in a letter to a friend. Of that, as well as everything else I know in Manila, is gone. General Yamashita remained elusive until the end of the war when he walked out of the mountains and surrendered. He was put on trial in the fall of 1945 in the first war crimes trial in all of Asia, accused of failing to control his troops. Yamashita blamed everything on Iwabuchi, even though evidence showed he was in touch with the admiral throughout most of the battle. Furthermore, Yamashita was no stranger to such horror. His own troops had killed thousands of Chinese in the wake of the fall of Singapore, while his chief of staff in the Philippines had played a critical role in the rape of Nanking. Over the course of 32 days, the Battle of Manila was replayed before a panel of five judges and a total of 16,000 spectators who jammed the courtroom, sitting shoulder to shoulder each day to watch the war crimes trial. A parade of 286 witnesses, doctors, lawyers, teachers, even gravediggers, testified about what happened to them and their families in the city. Yamashita was convicted on December 7, 1945. His dogged defense lawyers ultimately appealed his case all the way to the United States Supreme Court, but ultimately lost. On February 23, 1946, a year to the day after the Battle of Intramuros, in a sugarcane field 40 miles south of Manila, Yamashita was hanged, stripped of all his decorations and even his officers' uniforms, as MacArthur had ordered. Yamashita's trial had long been dogged by allegations of Victor's justice, the result in part of the defense counsel's tenacious work shaping the public narrative both during the trial and in the years afterward. Over the course of my research, however, I found among the personal letters of the presiding judge, Russell Reynolds, an interesting letter that he had sent to a friend of his, in which he wrote that the last time the judges met in Manila when they decided Yamashita's fate, they made a pact to never publicly speak about the trial of Yamashita, convinced that the thousands of pages of survivor testimony would stand on its own. Now, years later, as the allegations swirled around the trial and its fairness and whatnot, Reynolds was upset and alarmed that they had made this pact and were unable to sort of publicly rebut that. You can see here from the letter that he in his mind, was never any doubt over Yamashita's guilty and that his conscience remained, quote, clear as a bell. Yamashita's execution did little to provide the solace for victims, many of whom would spend years wrestling with physical torment. Others battled emotional wounds, and scores more struggled to understand the barbarity inflicted upon them. Quote, it was just total hatred and savagery, explained survivor Johnny Rocha. You cannot explain it. Nearly a half century after the battle, survivors formed an organization, the Memoriae Manila 1945 Foundation, dedicated to preserving the story of the civilian sacrifices during the city's liberation. To memorialize those killed, the organization erected a statue in Intramuros of a weeping mother cradling a dead infant surrounded by other dead and dying figures. The inscription on the base there provides a powerful epitaph. Quote, this memorial is dedicated to all those innocent victims of war, many of whom went nameless and unknown to a common grave, or never even knew a grave at all, their bodies having been consumed by fire or crushed to dust beneath the rubble of ruins. Let this monument be the gravestone for each and every one of them. Thank you. So I think I'll trade places with with Rich is going to...
Interesting, there's no word mention of who the enemy was or who destroyed the city. There's no mention of Japan.
Trade out and I will...
Very briefly. First of all, disclaimer, it turns out we ended up with the same publisher, and I later discovered, after I'd written review, the same editor of it over here. So, but when you read the review, it'll come out in the realistic proceedings. You'll see that I think it's a really wonderful book. It's a horrendous story. When I do a presentation, various titles, but this is typically it, and this is how I started. And the audience always looks at this, and you know what they think this is a picture of, right?
Hiroshima,
Nagasaki, maybe Tokyo, maybe some firebomb city. And we go along through the presentation, and at the end, I do the next slide. And then I go, next one, please. And I found over the years that this has a rather powerful impact.
I'm going to steal that idea, too. That's a really good idea.
It is a good idea.
I'm now working on a trilogy in the whole Asia-Pacific War from 37 to 45. It's the first, as far as I've been told, the first narrative in any language that attempts to really wrestle in the entirety of the Asia-Pacific War into one narrative. And it's not just a military history narrative, although there's obviously plenty of what I sometimes call bang bang. Obviously, you can't write about a war without mentioning there was some fighting taking place. But one of the themes that has really come through in this is you have not only the battles, but just the slaughter that takes place. And actually, I was led to this when I was doing the book Downfall, because when I set out to do that, I envisioned three set pieces. One was going to be the Tokyo fire raid to start the whole thing. And then one was going to be about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and one was going to be a thing to try to vivify and quantify the suffering of this enormous mass of Asians, primarily, under Japan's empire. And I found, and this is in the 70s and 80s, I found that it was very easy to find really high-quality English-language sources on the Tokyo fire raid, Hiroshima certainly. And then when I was looking for material about Asia, particularly China, I was drawing this enormous blank, that at that time, the published source material that talked about that was virtually non-existent. I ran into another scholar who was an American or Chinese ancestor who had been on the same search that I was on. He was commiserating with me that he'd also basically come up with a big blank. Now, I now know that part of this is because during the era of Mao Zedong in China, what we call the Second World War was grossly de-emphasized in terms of recent Chinese history. It was all about the revolution, the civil war, and all this stuff. One of the first signs of the sea change was after Mao died, there was in China this explosion of memoir literature about experiences during what we call the Second World War. And since that time, there's been this enormous change, and scholars like Rana Mitter at Oxford, Hans von der Ven at Cambridge, who are now good friends and colleagues and collaborators with me on this, have pointed out how over the last 15 or 20 years, we have a much, much fuller authoritative record from China about what went on at all levels. And amazingly enough, the fellow that we refer to as Chiang Kai-shek is now, in many areas of China, now a widely respected figure. He was a nationalist. He fought the Japanese and will pass over the late unpleasantness of the Civil War or whatever here. But that whole issue of death, and I've been working on and hope to do a major presentation on this, what I call Count All the Dead for the Asia-Pacific War. Typically now, we usually give a figure of about 60 million dead for the whole of World War II. Used to be about 50 million when the Oxford Companion to World War II was published. That was about the number. We're now at 60 million. Most of the argument seems to be towards higher than one of the lower numbers. I have to emphasize there's absolutely no way you can certify numbers from this. There was no one independent or with the ability to come around and count actually dead. So what we can, the best we can hope for is like a reasonable approximation figure, not a certifiable figure. And I've worked this on Asia Pacific, and I think roughly about 25 million total dead. Of that 25 million figure, about 6 million were combatants, soldiers, sailors, airmen, of whom pushing 3 million were Chinese, 2 million were Japanese, the balance of all others. That means there are 19 million non-combatant deaths, which is to say greater than 3-1, and I crunched similar numbers for Europe, and you can't, as awful as what happened in Europe was, you cannot get three dead non-combatants for every combatant in Europe. The best you can get is maybe two, and probably less than that, or whatever, which shows you one dimension about how horrific the war in Asia Pacific was. When you look at Japanese deaths, there was an official figure the Japanese, a post-war Japanese government issued saying the total number of non-combatant deaths was something less than 640,000 human beings. I've been using a figure of like 1 to 1.2 million basically to push that number as high as possible, because even if you push that number as high as possible, it leaves you with a startling conclusion that for every Japanese non-combatant who died in the war, 17 or 18 other non-combatants died. About 12 of them were Chinese. This is just, you know, and you talk about how events back then affect where we are now, why in China or Korea or the Philippines or other places these things are not forgotten or forgiven. This really connects back to that. James did a wonderful job of vivifying all of this incredible horror that takes place in Manila. And it is, you know, utterly appalling. I have to say that the there was a post-war, for the war crimes trials, Jim Zobel, mm-hmm. Gave me a, I'm sorry, Richard Mazzell, I'm sorry, he gave me a figure that was submitted early on in the war crimes trials where the Philippine government at the time was saying that they estimated that the total number of deaths in the Philippines was like 110,000 or something like that. But this was, I think, before they really had a comprehensive opportunity to scope out. You know, the figure that Jim used is 100,000 dead in Manila. This is one of those areas where, you know, the event is just so horrendous, like the Nanjing massacre. Mm-hmm. You can quibble about the numbers, but the horror and the magnitude of what took place, even at minimal numbers you use, are just so horrendous. And then the individual stories that James brings out just is, you know, why this took place, what it says about the Japanese of that era. You know, we can go on endlessly about that. I share, you know, exactly what James said. You know, basically, if Yamashita had not been tried in Manila and executed there, he would have been hauled down to Singapore, mm-hmm. where, if anything, his command responsibility for what went on, because there's no question that in Singapore, orders came from on high to conduct this slaughter of Chinese. Mm-hmm. And again, the exact numbers would go, you know, go back and forth, but it was,
yeah, the Japanese say 5,000, Singapore says 50,000.
Right, yeah. This is very typical of what goes on in a lot of these areas, which is, like I said, and we can get approximations, but for a lot of these events, it's just the sheer individual horror of the thing that just is absolutely appalling. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think, to conclude my comments, this is really what I think is important about this, because we simply have, for well and good reasons, we've emphasized what went on in the European phase of World War II. People know about Hitler. This is constantly being revived through history books, through the arts, to emphasize Hitler and the Holocaust and whatever here. And this whole enormous slaughter that took place in Asia, the extent of it and the degree to which it still resonates in Asian relationships right down to today is so critical. And this is merely one awful component of it. You could do, I don't know how many of these for China. It's just, you know, one continuous horse. And then the final comment is, not only there, for instance, when the Japanese overran Burma in 1942, there was a substantial population of individuals from India who followed the British Empire into Burma. And they had a very troubled relationship with the Burmese. When the Japanese rolled in, the Indians realized that their status under the new occupying power was likely to be, and there was this enormous flight of refugees trekking out, because they waited late, trekking out over the mountains to try to get back to India. And you can get numbers for deaths there. There's an early report about 5,000. There's later reports claiming alien. I'm having a senior moment on it. Trust me, it's like 70,000, 80,000. And another recent one by an Indian historian saying at least 50,000 Indians perished in this mass walkout of Burma. Just story after story after story, and you go down through the Japanese advance everywhere they went. Even when they're winning, they are slaughtering civilians, slaughtering POWs or whatever here. It's just a horrendous, horrendous story. Thank you.
Thank you. like to open it up for questions, comments, observations. What would produce this tariff, Sharon?
The idea that the Yamashita trial was fair and the deciding of the minority Can you talk a little bit more about why you think the evidence suggests that he was guilty?
Well, I'll tell you, the Yamashita's trial, it was a very unorthodox trial. I mean, the regulations were 21 regulations that guided that trial, and they were written by MacArthur and his staff, and they allowed things that are not allowed in American courtrooms, like hearsay evidence, triple hearsay evidence even, and things like that. A lot, one of the great things in sort of that, go back a little bit just before the trial. As soon as the U.S. got into Manila at the end of the battle, we realized we were looking less at a battlefield and more of a crime scene. And so we brought in tons and tons of investigators who fanned out through the city and who did interviews with literally thousands of survivors. And many of these were done bedside in cots and field hospitals. Wounds were photographed, sketches were made of the inside of buildings and churches and things like that, and maps were made. A lot of those are images you saw here, for instance, of the men whose necks had been cut. All of that, they spent the entire summer building all of that evidence, and it's literally probably 30,000 pages of these documents from the National Archives, which became the basis for the Yamashita trial and the subsequent trials after that. That said, as much as dogged as they were in doing this, because you have to remember they're fanning out across a wrecked city to try and find these testimonies, it's really only just a scratching at the surface of it all, because so many families were, you take the family, for instance, of Far Eastern University, Nick Reyes, who was a prominent man in Manila, academic, and almost his entire family was wiped out. There's no record anywhere in any of the war crimes testimony of what happened to his family. So if most of your family was killed and nobody knew to report it, it didn't get covered. Or if you fled Manila afterwards because there were 200,000 people homeless and conditions were atrocious and you went to stay with your family in the provinces, it wasn't necessarily reported. So despite all that effort during that sort of spring and summer, it's really not a full snapshot of what actually happened. But it was the best that we could do in those kinds of circumstances. And in that said, it's very thorough. When Yamashita was actually put on trial, he was brought up on about 123, 124 charges. That in each of those charges were these individual massacres and things like that, some of them which took place outside of Manila. Those charges actually equated about 62,000 people who had been killed during that time period. So when they're taking all this evidence and that they've gathered and they've spent this 6 months preparing and they're getting ready to put him on trial, they write the court regulations which allow, which are a lot looser than what would be allowed in an American courtroom. Statements from those who were too injured or couldn't be located afterwards were allowed to be entered into the record against Yamashita. Typically in an American courtroom you have the right to confront your accuser, and in this case Yamashita didn't have that right. I mean, how could he refute what was said if the person wasn't there? And furthermore, his defenders were really only given a handful of weeks to prepare this trial, which gave them no opportunity to sort of mount a counter defense to say, someone else would have done it. I mean, they had no time to re-interview witnesses. They had no time to go out and conduct their own investigations and whatnot. And so the Army had really a huge six-month head start and far more resources. So the defense that they were able to mount was literally one in which they just simply tried to defend him as best they could and bring in character witnesses. So that's sort of the trial, sort of in a nutshell of it. That said, his defense lawyers did an amazing job. Frank Reel, who was one of his defense lawyers, was a labor lawyer from Boston who got the case that nobody wanted, and he fought tenaciously for his client. In fact, in the personal letters of Reynolds and some of the others, they actually mentioned what a stunning job the defense had done given the resources they had. So that's a lot of the lack of fairness, if you will, and sort of mounting that by American standards. Now, I will say it's, and there have been a few books done on Yamashita's trial and things like that. There was also I think part of what happened in Yamashita was at the end of the Battle of Manila, and you have to remember this is just, he walks out of the jungle literally just days after World War II is officially ended, surrenders, and he's brought back into the city that's totally wrecked. And it's so wrecked, in fact, and people, and the bodies that have been buried in people's yards that when it rains, they float back up. I mean, the ruins of war are everywhere. And he's brought into this courtroom, which is at the High Commissioner's place, and it's still battle-scarred with shrapnel on the walls, and he's put on trial there. And really, I think someone had to pay for all of that.